I'm gonna be totally really, really basic. So I'm not gonna say anything fancy, or at least try not to. Also, I have to apologize. My credit card was stolen, so I haven't been able to prepare as much for this because I have to deal with that. So take what you can get. Okay, yeah, so I'll tell you about ADS Mira, right? Which is the idea that that the ADS CFT correspondence, which is really something coming from something having to do with quantum gravity. Is somehow closely related to Mira, which is, you know, a subset of tensor network methods that really hail from condensed matter physics and quantum information. So how we could take this structure and see some of the features of this structure reflected in it. So I'm going to really start from here, and then later tell you a little bit about this and how there's some matching. So first, let's do Mira. So Mira stands for multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. So it's really a variational wave function, which is supposed to capture the properties of critical systems, critical points. It's primarily been studied in one dimension, but we actually know many exact solutions in higher dimensions as well, which I'll tell you about one of them a little bit later on. And so the setup for Mira is the following. We're just doing condensed matter physics in one dimension, let's say. So we have sites like this. And these sites may have some degrees of freedom on them. Right? So there may be a spin, which could be up or down, like this. So there's a local Hilbert space, which in this case is C2. And then we have a Hamiltonian, which is also local, which is a sum of terms, which couple, for example, site x and site x plus 1. And in fact, if I made the dimension of these local spaces big enough, this would be the most generic thing. But more generally, I could have, you know, some higher order terms. Like I could have a something like this as well. So this would be nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor. Okay. So this is the setup, and I wanna imagine. So we know if this Hamiltonian is gapped, so there's a ground state, which I'll just call zero. This is the ground state. And then there's a first excited state. We know that if the system is gapped, which means that E1 minus E0 equals delta independent of number of sites, which I'll call L. So if this is true, then this problem is easy. Actually, it's now known rigorously, completely rigorously, there is a polynomial time algorithm that you can run on a classical computer to find the ground state in a certain representation called a matrix product state in polynomial time, okay, as long as you have this gap. So that problem is actually completely solved in the sense that there is an algorithm which is a black box algorithm. You just give it the Hamiltonian along with a promise that the gap is a certain amount, and it will find the ground state for you. But a more interesting situation is when, so gapped, as I just said, is doable. But what about gapless? Right, so you may have, for example, as a function of some tuning parameter, you may have two different phases for Hamiltonian. So for example, let's think about the Ising Hamiltonian, transverse field Ising model, minus sum over all sites. Let me just use a different letter, R. So this is a term which encourages the spins to line up together, right? And there's another term here, which wants the spins to polarize in the x direction. And when g is equal to 1, there's a transition. For g much less than 1, sigma z has an expectation value. And for bigger than 1, it has no expectation value. So this is a symmetry-breaking transition. And there's a critical theory here. And what happens as you plot the gap as a function of g is that at 1, it goes down like that. So everywhere over here, the system is solvable from this general one-dimensional algorithm. But at this exact point, things become more difficult. Yeah?
Quick question. What restrictions do we have in the locality of our Hamiltonian right now?
Oh, let's say it's just nearest neighbor. So the specific setup would be that I have a finite dimensional local Hilbert space, and I have nearest neighbor interactions. And if there's a gap in that general setting, the constant is easy to find.
But it says the algorithm doesn't work for next.
No, it would work for that too. But the way to cast this into this original form is just to make a supersite, which contains two of the original sites. And then it's a slightly bigger local Hilbert space. And then nearest neighbor interactions. Now, I want to emphasize, as a practical matter, it may be better not to do that. It may be better to treat the nearest second neighbor Hamiltonian, you know, in a different way or something. But at least in principle, conceptually, you can do that. You can always kind of coarse grain everything to a single site and then just look at nearest neighbor interactions. Okay, so the gap goes to 0. And in fact, if you look at this, exactly at this g equals 1 point, the gap goes like 1 over L, where L is the system size, again. So this is the kind of place that we'd like to apply, you know, some new ideas. And the important idea is that at this place, at this point, g equals 1, you have scale invariance. So for example, this sigma z at x, or let me write this way. Maybe this is in the way. I'll write a little higher. Like this. And this delta is actually 1/8. It's a known number. So you see you have a power law decay of correlations, whereas in the gapped case, everything would decay exponentially. And that's really the scale invariance. And so the idea of MIRA was invented to try to deal with these kind of systems, where you have scale invariance and long-range correlations. The other interesting fact about this is that if you look at this is correlations. If you look at entanglement, which will play an important role, so how is that defined? So I take a subsystem of length, let's say R, length R. So you have a big ring of total size L, and you take a little chunk of it of size R. And then you form the reduced density matrix of that little segment, which is defined as tracing out everything which is not in R. So you trace out all this stuff of this entire system density matrix. So let's just say we put the ground state here. So this is like the state of the entire system in density matrix form. And here you trace out all the degrees of freedom that are outside the little region you care about. And as we'll see in a second, if this system had no correlations, if it was a product state, then this entropy of this density matrix would now be 0. But in fact, it's non-zero in this situation. So we define the entanglement entropy to be the von Neumann entropy, or now I trace over the subsystem itself, of rho r log rho r, like this. So this is the definition of the entanglement entropy. And for this g equals 1 critical point, what you find is that S of r goes like some number called the central charge, C, which is in this case is a half. Okay, let me get out of the way. So this is the definition, and this is what you find for this critical point where you have long-range correlations. So that means, what does this S of r mean? What is it viscerally? Well, you should just think of saying that r has entanglement with the rest of the system, which means it shares singlets with that system, right? So there are spins in this model that are entangled with each other, like in a singlet. And there's some entanglement which starts in r and goes to l minus r. And this roughly counts how many singlets these systems share. And if it was a gap system, then this would be a constant, independent of r. So we see that in these critical systems in one dimension, they have long-range correlations, parallel decaying correlations, they're scale invariant, and they have a lot of entanglement. Okay, and they're sort of very different from gap systems in one dimension. Right, so how can we think about these things? So let's start, let me make a hierarchy of entanglement, or let's say entangled states. So the least entangled is if you have no entanglement at all. So this would be a situation where you have a state of the whole system, which is just a product of some state. Let's say it's spin up on every site. So that's like the starting point. That's a product state. There's no entanglement here because everybody's uncorrelated with everybody else. Okay, and you can make these states different, that's fine. But it just as long as it's a product state, that's okay. And this starting point is what we would call mean field theory. So you can say mean field theory can be taken to say that you assume the state of the system is a product state, and you find the best product state with the lowest energy, and take that as your variational wave function. Okay. And that may work quite well in these regions of the phase diagram where there's a gap, because correlations are short-ranged. So although it's not exactly a product state, it's close to being a product state, perhaps in some sense. So the next thing you could do is to have nearest neighbor entanglement. So that would be something like, let's say these two spins could be correlated somehow. So they could be in a singlet. And the next two spins could be in a singlet. And so on. Right. So now there's a little bit of entanglement here. It's very short-ranged. And notice, if I do this procedure, you know, that I was talking about before, if I coarse grain, if I view this as a supersite now, then there's no entanglement. I'm back to this situation. Right, so this is the guts of the intuition, is that if you had any kind of finite amount of entanglement, you zoom out enough, it'll look like a product state. Okay. And so something I could do, next nearest neighbor entanglement, then if I had, maybe I could have something like this, where I'm not going to write the detailed state, and so on. Right? So you have a kind of hierarchical structure of entanglement in this system. So that's kind of that's how we'd like to think about the entanglement structure. At least that's a guess for it. And why is this a reasonable guess? Because the Hamiltonian is local, right? So the first thing it wants to do this guy, it wants to correlate the nearest neighbor degrees of freedom. And then later on, maybe in some normalization group sense, it will correlate longer range degrees of freedom. But the dominant effect is to couple two nearby spins. Okay, so this is the kind of like hierarchy of entangled states. So now let me just write down a general mirror. And we'll try to see how this corresponds to this hierarchy of states. So I have a bunch of sites like this. Some number of sites. And the idea is the following. There's some state here, psi. So let's say it's 0 at g equals 1 of this model. So it's the ground state at the critical point. So this thing, because it's scale invariant, it's going to have entanglement at all length scales. That's a naive expectation. And so how can we represent that? Well, we should try to somehow decompose the entanglement in this system scale by scale in this kind of picture here. So there's short-range entanglement, slightly longer-range entanglement, slightly longer-range entanglement, and so forth. And so the idea of Mira is to say something like this. Suppose I acted with some unitary transformation between nearest neighbor degrees of freedom, like this. Then what could this unitary transformation do? Well, it could remove this kind of entanglement, right? I can get rid of a singlet by doing a unitary transformation on these two spins. Right. But it can't actually get rid of this entanglement, because that's a tripartite. It's a longer range entanglement. So these little guys can touch, they can affect this sort of extreme short range entanglement, but they can't affect the longer range entanglement. So the idea would be I would sort of take these transformations, and I would use them to remove as much short range entanglement as I can possibly remove. With the goal being, for example, to decouple these sites. So I'd make this transformation, and what I'm left over with is some transformed degrees of freedom. And so if my state was like this, I could do a transformation to remove this entanglement, then it's a product state, and I can stop. But in general, what I can do is I can remove some of the degrees of freedom. So now let me draw like this. So now I have a second transformation, which is like a coarse graining transformation. So my goal in the first step was to remove some short range entanglement, to take some of these local singlets and rotate them into product states, and then throw away those product states. That's what this transformation is doing. But I'm not affecting the long range entanglement. That's still present. Because I can't touch that entanglement with these short range unitary transformations. So I can draw it like this. I can say that there's an extra degree of freedom coming out, which I just put into, let's say, spin up. So this picture just represents, I take the state, I apply a transformation to it, if you like. And then I have some other transform state, which is a consisting in this approximation of some product degrees of freedom, which I just throw away, and some other degrees of freedom that I keep. Right. And again, if the state had this structure, then I would be done. This would just be a product state here. But suppose the state was a little bit more complicated. Suppose it had not nearest neighbor entanglement, but next nearest neighbor entanglement. So it had a little bit of extra long-range entanglement. Well, then I'd probably need to do this again. I remove a little bit more entanglement at a slightly longer scale, like this. So now I can really affect entanglement at the second level, where I have, you know, I have not two spins involved, but four spins in the original description. And then I can coarse grain again. So this is a choice that you have. So in practice, what's done, or the simplest thing to do is the following. So let me say one more thing, and then I'll come back to this. So if you had a general system of else, say to the U sites, like this, then you could do U layers of your normalization. And you would have, at the end, only one site, right? So you go from L to L over 2 to L over 4 all the way down to one site, right? So in this way, you've shrunk the entire system to a single point. Okay, and you have this big layer of transformations. So yeah, so to answer your question, the most obvious thing to do, viewing this as a variational ansatz, is to take this wave function with general tensors, general unitary transformations for all these little objects, and use it to minimize the energy using some algorithm. And then whatever that spits out for you, that's your approximation to the ground state. And then you can use that to calculate observables. So what I'm really describing to you right now is a kind of conceptual motivation for thinking that this ansatz is a good one. And then when you actually want to work with it, the thing you mostly do is to minimize the energy and find, you know, the best tensors that do that, the best unitary transformations. Okay. If you have a small enough thing, you might be able to do it analytically. I don't know. Usually to get good results, you need to do numerically, but actually a little bit, in just a second, I'll actually show you an example where you can do it analytically in two dimensions. Yeah, I'll talk about the toric code. Okay, so this is the picture. And let me just now talk about how this thing looks reasonable from the point of view of correlations and entanglements. Which is what we said were some of the more interesting features of the critical theory. Right. So I have this entanglement and then this kind of correlation here, which I'd like to understand in this network. So the way you can do that is to let's imagine first you want to do some correlation functions, right? So this network gets hard to draw very quickly. So I'll try to kind of make a caricature of it, something like this. So these are the different layers. And if you wanted to compute a correlation function, what would you do? You would put some operators here, O1 and O2, like that. And then you'd put I didn't really draw this very well. You'd put the other network on top of it, the bra and the get, right? You'd put the operators in between them, and you'd connect them. This and put all the other sites just go through, and then you contract this network. That's the correlation function. Right? But this network has a really nice property because these are unitaries, right? So if I put an operator in right here, then these unitaries over here, they just go away. It's UU deck. So you have rules like this. U inverse, and rules like this. All right, so this makes the network easy to contract. And so what happens is you can apply the first layer, and then most of these tensors disappear. these unitaries. But there's a few that are near the operator. They get changed. They get affected somehow. So you can draw a picture where these operators essentially move down one layer. And they're different operators now. We call it operator at layer 1, operator 2 at layer 1. And then you can change them again, operator 1 at layer 2, operator 2 at layer 2, like that, and so on. And why am I drawing them getting close together? Because every time I do this, I cut out half the sites. So if they started out separated by L, or by R, let's say, then later they're separated by R over 2, and then R over 4, and then quickly, in logarithmic time, they collide. So I'm looking at O1 of R, O2 of 0. Then this can be calculated in log R steps, right? Where I just do this layer log R times, and then after that, they're net to each other, and I can compute. And so the idea is if, suppose, that this operator O1 at layer 1 is equal to some constant, which is a property of the operator, times the operator at layer 0, which is times the operator. This is just the same as the operator. Suppose that were true. Right, as viewed as an operator on these little local sites now. Right, and suppose this kept being true, that O1 of K was lambda to the K, O1, like that. Well, then you can see what will happen. They go down log R steps. So what I get is O1 at R, O2 at 0, goes like lambda to the K, lambda to the K, O1 at 1, O2 at 0, where this K is equal to log R. Everyone understand that calculation? I'm just applying this formula. I'm just doing it. I'm saying every time I do the renormalization, one layer of the RG, I get the same operator back with a prefactor. And how many times do I have to do it before they next to each other? So there's no interesting position dependence here. There are just two operators right next to each other on the lattice, so it's just a number. This is equal to some constant. In particular, it's independent of R. So then the prefactor is the only dependence. So what do I get? I get goes like 1 over R to the 2 delta, where delta is related to lambda. Right, because it's something to the log R power. So that's a power law. So to be precise, this is like a 2-to-1 RG scheme. And so if lambda was 2-to-the-minus delta, and it's log base 2 of R, then that makes it work. Okay, so we get power law correlations out. And similarly, if you wanted to calculate the entanglement entropy of a region, how would you do that? Well, there's some region here, but when you coarse grain, that region shrinks by a factor of 2 every time. Right? So and if it's of size R, then after log R steps, it goes to 0. Or it goes to a single site, say, or a few sites. So I can start with a few sites in here which have bounded entropy. And I apply the network in reverse. Once, twice, log R times. Every time I apply one layer of the network, I can add a little bit of short-range entanglement. Right? That's, remember these guys here. They can add or remove a little bit of entanglement locally. So I do this log R times, and what do I get? I get a total amount of entanglement that I can add, which is proportional to log R, which is exactly this formula here. So you can interpret the entanglement that these things are adding or removing at every step as like proportional to the central charge, which is like the number of degrees of freedom in the theory. Yeah. Yeah, so this is a particular operator. So this is a general network, right? And I can put many operators in here. And only for some special operators is it true that the operator, when renormalized, gives back itself. So this is like a definition of an important operator. This is the definition of a scaling operator. So for these subset of operators, you can calculate, their dimensions are determined by the network, by sort of diagonalizing, if you like, the action of one layer of the RG on all operators. Yeah?
So are we saying at every level of this thing, the action is, so are we just making assumptions on those operators, or is there something we should say about what the action of every level is? So is it the same action as the last? So at every level, you have something that's coming out of, so you have something that's easy to track.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. So the idea would be, like, say at the critical point, every tensor is the same this way and this way. So it's scale invariant. Like everything is the same as a function of position and RG scale, link scale. Right. So yeah. So this formula, just iterating this formula at the next layer implies this formula if all the tensors are the same. You mean without just computing the entropy directly? Who said that? Like from a single tensor, let's say. Like, is it in? I mean, it's clearly in the data of a single tensor. I mean, yeah. Maybe I don't understand what the rules of what you want to. It's definitely. I think it's doable. Okay. Yeah. How do you apply this thing? Okay. Oh yeah, I understand. So here's the logics. You start with the Hamiltonian. You make a network with arbitrary tensors in your computer, then you optimize those tensors to find the lowest energy you can find. That's your candidate for the ground state. Then you take that tensors that you found in your computer and use it to compute this spectrum. And then from that, you can identify what conformal field theory or whatever, or, you know, maybe it's not a conformal field theory, maybe it's something more general. You can calculate the physical properties of your ground state. So that's the most naive logic. You start from a Hamiltonian, you minimize the energy, then you compute physical properties. After you get the ground state.
I use this one to find out like the eigen operator is
So like here we know more or less what the CFT is gonna be, but there are models where we don't know the answer. So you would just do this and then see what you get out. Like you'd see the central charge is 7/10. So it's tricriticalizing, or you know, whatever it is, right? So in principle, it's a discovery tool. You know, you can use it to figure out what you're looking at. But now you could also conceptually, at least, think about trying to, like, I give you a state and you try to decompose it in this language. But that's a different and much harder problem than sort of using this as a variational ansatz. Does that answer your question?
Okay.
So now let me just tell you a little bit about ADS-CFT. So you can see why this network looks sort of like that. Yeah. Well, that's the original MIRA. More recently, we've been considering situations where they're not just in product states.
So basically, all this analysis is good set. Like the scaling of entropy and everything still assumes that they're in a product state.
Yes. If they're not in a product state, you can get. So, for example, if you put them into the inverse of this network, then you get out at the top a product state. Right? If you just did the reverse of all the W's and U's. So in principle, if you make them sufficiently entangled, you can just undo everything. Okay, ADS-CFT. So this is, again, really, this CFT, you should just, I mean, this is not really right, but just think about the transverse field Eisen model again. Now, the CFTs for which this is believed to be true, well, I believe it's true for every CFT, but the CFTs for which it's usefully true are very different from this scale invariant critical points. But for the purposes here, let's just imagine, just keep this in your mind. So what does this thing say? It says that the CFT is just equal to a theory of gravity. So let's say a CFT in d plus 1 dimensions is just equal to gravity in d plus 2 dimensions, for example. Simplest. And by this, gravity is quantum, and this is, of course, also quantum. But in certain limits of this gravitational theory, so like in our universe, you know, the Hubble radius is really, really large, the Planck length is really, really small, so gravity behaves like a semi-classical field, right? We don't see gravitons running around, unfortunately. So we take a limit to get classical gravity. And this, on this side, is like what's called a large n limit. So you get some CFT, which is in what we call a large n CFT. And what this means, this large n means there's lots of local degrees of freedom. So these little sites that I drew at the very beginning, instead of having two sites on them, two states, they may have, you know, 50 million states on them. And for example, these would be, like, you may have, so an example of this would be SUN gauge theory with n goes to infinity at some critical point. So this is the kind of thing that people talk about in ADS-CFT. So now I have many, many degrees of freedom. I have, you know, instead of three colors of quarks, I have n colors of quarks, where n is a million. And this large n, what it does is it makes things kind of semi-classical. So you could think of it as sort of like small h-bar. It suppresses loop effects in the field theory. So it makes things semi-classical. Okay, I'm not going to say much more about this, but this is a particular limit. And so in this limit, you have classical gravity instead of quantum gravity. And this is something we know a lot about. And so then, because this is believed, well, this is really what we have evidence for, primarily, is this large n CFT is the same as classical gravity. We have much less evidence for this claim here, but we believe it's true. And so, you know, if this general claim is true, then this specific claim is true. And this is a very powerful tool, because classical gravity is something that you can compute with, whereas this is, in principle, a very difficult object to work with. It may be strongly interacting, it may have many properties that are hard to calculate, but you could go to the gravity side and get something simple. Yeah? Yes, in some cases you can. Well, okay, I can't really give a very detailed example. Well, so let's say you could have a this is in 2+1 dimensions. You could, for example, have on each of these links a link variable, v r r prime, which is an SUN matrix. And then on the sites, you could have, or also on the links, you could have some fermions, which are, for example, in component fermions. Or you could have some bosons. Or these bosons and fermions may also be SUN matrices. That's also allowed, right? So you, starting from something like this, you know, a lattice model, which is in principle not so different from this, the microscopic level, and the kind of things that people in lattice gauge theory do all the time. You know, starting from this model, you can, in some cases, construct lattice models you believe flow at long distances to these interesting CFTs. But this is actually generally a very hard problem to figure out what flows where. It's a complicated dynamical question. And what's worse is that many of these CFTs also have supersymmetry, so they have a lot of fine-tuning. In a sense, the CFT is very special. It's not like a single critical point where you have to tune one parameter to get there. You have to tune 10 parameters or 15 parameters in your microscopic theory to reach the critical point. So we would say it's a multi-critical point. And so in that sense, it's sort of a very special beast. But the hope of ADS-MIRA would be that actually this general picture that I'm going to tell you in just a second is much more broadly applicable, or to understand where the limits are. Yeah?
So part of the power of ADS-CFT is, as you mentioned, the separation between Hubble
yes.
and the fact that it's possible. So in MIRA, it seems like even if you started with something that's like a large and gauge theory, you still, it's sort of built into the structure of the network that the Planck scale is like the order this ADS radius. Has anybody tried to look at different network topologies or things that might have a
Yeah, this is a great question. So jumping ahead a little bit, what I'll tell you indeed is that these tensors should be thought of as like little chunks of space of size the ADS radius. And that every theory is local in that scale in the bulk, in the gravitational theory. But in general, yeah, indeed, if you have a small Planck length, so you have locality to much smaller scales, then there should be some special structure. So what I've tried to do a little bit is to look in the detailed structure of the tensors to see if there's a sense which, you know, if you kind of look inside the tensor, you see, you know, another little chunk, you know, you see another flat space somehow emerging. Now, I can't be super precise about that because I don't really know the answer. But I think that's one of the main directions that is completely open right now, is to understand how from the tensors there emerges this microscopic locality. And that really has to do with the spectrum of scaling dimensions, right? When you have microscopic locality, you have a very sparse spectrum. So it's saying that when I do this calculation here that I talked about to calculate the spectrum of dimensions, that should be very sparse. So these tensors should have a very special property, so the spectrum is sparse. So there should be a structure. We know there's structure in there, which tells you that the space is local. We just don't know how to extract it. So that's a great question. Okay, so. Yeah, so let me draw a picture now. So ADS, so this is some geometry, and the idea is this is supposed to be dual to the ground state of the CFT. So in other words, you have a state here, and that corresponds to some geometry on the gravity side. And again, there's an extra dimension here, so there's one extra degree of freedom, which I'll call R. That's the radial direction, which we'll interpret as renormalization group scale or length scale. And this thing has a geometry which looks like this. Okay, so it's like a Minkowski space. So this is ADS 2 plus 1. So it's sort of like Minkowski space, where I have time and x and then this other direction. But then I have this prefactor. So everything gets multiplied by this 1 over r. Right, so where you are in r tells you the proper times and distances that you measure locally. And so just so we're completely clear, in this case, x, you can think of as running from minus infinity to infinity. R is 0 to infinity. So this is r equals 0. That's the edge. And t, you know, is minus infinity to infinity. Like that. So this is fixed time. Say t equals 0. And I have this space, which has this geometry. And so the first thing you can ask questions, you know, what's the simplest way to picture this geometry is to draw geodesics, minimal curves. So if I have two points here, separated by a distance r, then what is the minimal curve? Who knows, actually? It's a semicircle, right? This is the famous Poincaré half plane. So it's a semicircle whose equation is like this. Just half of a circle. And the length of this curve turns out to be 2 times the ADS radius times log r over what I'll call a. So let's understand this formula. So first of all, what is a? A is how close to zero I get in little r. So it's a UV cutoff. So you have to put a little dashed line here and say, actually, the geometry doesn't go on forever. It stops at r equals a. And that's like the lattice constant of the theory. Because this geometry is actually formally infinite. It takes forever to go in space from here to the boundary. That's what A is. So it's like a UV cutoff. Okay, and this L ADS is the ADS radius, and this is just comes from the two sides of this thing. And so now we can do something cool. We can use the Ryu Takinagi formula, which says that the area of this curve is related to the entropy, the entanglement entropy, of this region in the boundary field theory. So it says the entropy of R is equal to the length over 4 g Newton. This is Newton's constant. So this should be compared with the Bekenstein-Hawking formula which says that S black hole is equal to the area of the black hole horizon over 4 g Newton. So this is the famous, if you have a black hole in three plus one dimensional space, it has a two-dimensional horizon, the area of that horizon in Planck units is in terms of Newton's constant is the entropy of the black hole. So this is an analogous formula, but in a world where gravity lives in 2 plus 1 dimensions instead of 3 plus 1. So now black holes would have not an area, but a circumference. And so you'd put the length here instead of the area. But what do we calculate, actually? Well, this is log r, right? So indeed, we just get that this is equal to L ADS over g Newton times log r over a. And in fact, you can also show that this ratio is a central charge. Equals c. So you recover the CFT formula for entanglement entropy. From basically saying that this curve is like a sort of like a black hole horizon. It represents the, you know, some kind of ignorance about what's happening beyond that curve. It's a holographic screen. And so the other thing is, in these correlations, right, so correlations, to do correlations, you do the same kind of thing, R next. So you wanted to calculate the correlation function of two operators in the boundary, so you draw them like this. And then what you'd say, well, so the general answer in ADS-CFT is that you solve a wave equation. So you sort of imagine that this operator makes some waves, which come in, and they get scattered up to here. And that tells you the effective response due to plugging this guy in up there. That's what ADS-CFT tells you. But you can simplify this in a certain limit. And in that limit, what you find is not these waves, but you find that it's, again, geodesics. So how does this work? Why is this the right answer? Well, the dictionary, ADS-CFT, says you take an operator, O, and it corresponds to a bulk field, a bulk particle, phi, and then this field has some mass, m. Right? And if this mass, m, is sufficiently heavy, right, then you can do geometric optics. Right? If you have a heavy object, which is moving like a wave, but you look longer than its inverse Compton wavelength, then it looks like a particle. It's sort of like ordinary quantum mechanics of particles. And so the solution to the wave equation is the same as doing the path integral. The quantum mechanics path integral of this particle is some mass in this space. But if that particle is very heavy, right, so its action is you do a path integral over the particle, of e to the minus m times the length. That's the action of a relativistic particle. It's the length of its world line. Then you see that when m is very large, this can be done by saddle point. And so you just find the minimum length. And that's where these geodesics come from. And then the propagator is just the path integral evaluated on the minimum length configuration, the minimum action configuration. So it's just geodesic. And so you get that O1 of R, O2 of 0 goes like E to the minus M 2 L ADS log R over A. We just calculated this up here. And so this tells you that this is 1 over R to the 2 delta, where delta is m times the ADS radius. So the mass of the bulk particle measured in units of the ADS radius is the dimension of the boundary operator. Okay. This is just a very brief, I'm just really telling you how to calculate things, not really where this comes from or anything. But now I want to draw some comparisons. And the idea is really to just very, very literally take this network very literally as a graph, which is like some kind of discrete space, which mimics the geometry of antidistortor space. That's just be completely literal. So let me draw these kind of pictures again. And I'm going to abstract a little bit. So here's the original lattice. Let's say I do a 2-to-1 scheme like that. So that's an abstraction of what I did before, where I'm lumping the disentangling into these little bonds here, and I'm doing the coarse graining in this kind of little line. So it's just a graph. All right. And this graph is roughly showing you the connectivity of the Mira network. I haven't gone into exactly all the details, but it has all the right basic structure. And so this graph immediately, OK, so what is this graph? This is the Mira graph. And what's the first observation? Well, the first observation is that its metric behaves, that if I take that graph and give it like a taxicab metric, it behaves very similar to this metric, to this spatial part. In what sense? This is x, and this is like log r. Right? So if I go down one step, put it like this. So one step in u is like doubling the lattice constant, right? So I'm shrinking the length by factor. So at this level, the distance between two points, the horizontal distance equals, let's say, L, or R, that's what I've been using. At this level, the horizontal distance equals R over 2, which is and at this level, the horizontal distance equals r over 4a equals r over r equals 4a. So I'm just showing you explicitly that r is getting bigger by a factor of 2 every time, and the distances are correspondingly shrinking. And that's exactly what this metric tells you. The proper distance horizontally at fixed r is just x over r. Yeah. No, it's a property of the structure of Mira.
But whatever coarse graining would give it every, I mean, if that is an RG flow, every RG flow on the CFP side should exactly give the radius and the metric. Otherwise, it's a mistake that maybe that CFP doesn't give the RG flow picture. So, if the RG flow.
No, I'm not saying it's a profound statement. I'm saying, I think that the way to actually think about it is that it's demystifying what's happening here. Right, this is not some magical thing. It's just saying this metric is basically fixed by scale invariance to have this form. It has to have that property that when I coarse grain by a factor of 2, distances are effectively, you know, shrunk by a factor of 2, right? So it's just doing something very basic. Right? This metric is not by itself a very magical thing. That's what I'm trying to show you.
I guess my question is more like, is this just like the statement Mira has to do something with
I would say at this point it's the statement that they both have something to do with an RG flow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, definitely there are subtleties. Sorry? Yeah. So the first thing which is really ugly about this is that it breaks translation invariance. You have to pick which two to group at every time. So it's kind of really nasty in that way. Which people don't like this so much because it has this translation breaking. Now, if you do the RG, if you minimize the energy, then it looks more or less translation invariant. I mean, there's up to some error, it's translation invariant. But it's not, you know, so maybe the formalism could be improved on this side. So that's one very important difference. A similarity would be that if you looked at the graph Laplacian on this graph, it has the same low-lying eigenvalues as the Laplacian on that space. So the best we can hope for is that in the sense that, you know, if I was hopping on a square lattice, that mimics diffusion in the long distance limit. Perhaps hopping on this lattice in some appropriate limit really mimics motion on that space. That's the best you could hope for. But there are a lot of issues, especially translation invariance is a big issue in this thing. Yeah.
So
Not that I know of. This is an open question. So you can do what's called continuous MIRA, which obviously I won't have. I've already spoken for an hour, so obviously I won't talk about that. But yes, in principle, you do have translation variance. So continuous MIRA is one way to restore translation variance, but it also has a. It doesn't seem to handle interactions very well. And it's not a very numerically tractable scheme so far. So, you know, I want to emphasize this really works. You know, you can find answers to actual questions. C-MIRA seems mostly so far to be a tool for analyzing free field theories, which we already know how to do. So maybe you can look at them in a slightly different way, but it's not giving you a lot of really new information. So I would say finding a way to restore translation invariance in this picture, or somehow making C-MIRA better or finding some other continuous version of this story is a major open problem in this whole program. Right. And so, yeah, so you have these horizontal things, right, but you can also go down, right? And going down, you know, if you go this way, then at every step you bring things closer by a factor of 2. And so again, in log r steps, you've kind of come to a point, right? So it's saying, you know, the minimum number of steps you can take to go from here to here, you should just go down in the network first and then go back up. That's actually the minimum number of, that's the minimum distance in this graph, is to go down in the bulk and then back up. And that's the same, or very similar to these JD6 here, where you go down and then go back up. That's the minimum length. Okay. And now similarly, you remember I told you that if you had these operators, O1 equals lambda O0, like this, so the operator at layer 0 is operator at layer 1. I mean, operator at layer 1 is operator at layer 0 times lambda. And I told you that lambda was like 2 to the minus delta. Then what is this saying? It's like saying the operator is moving through this network. Right, that's what the normalization is doing. I move it from layer to layer. So as it moves to the network, its amplitude gets reduced by a power of lambda every time. Right, I get lambda, lambda, lambda. And the higher the dimension, the more gets reduced. So that's exactly like what's happening in this particle picture. Right, the action is minus m times the length. So the farther it goes, the more suppressed the amplitude. So it's like high-dimension operators have a lot of trouble moving through the network. They get killed really rapidly, whereas low-dimension operators can move quickly. Or they can move easily in the sense that they don't get, their amplitude doesn't die away as fast. So there's a sense in which this delta is like measuring the mass, if you will, or the ease at which this operator propagates through the network. And so low-dimension operators, if I said that, you know, this is like a chunk of space of size the ADS radius. Then low-dimension operators are operators indeed whose dimension or their mass is of order 1 over L ADS. And operators that if you push them through one layer were heavily suppressed. So for example, if delta was really large. So high-dimension operators, these are suppressed. Which you can interpret as saying, well, they have a really big mass, but they actually have to travel a really long distance. They have to go an entire ADS radius, whereas their mass is much bigger than the ADS, 1/ADS radius. So they get heavily suppressed. So this is indeed the sense in which I think within the tensors themselves, there's some notion of some new space, some microspace, where if you only have a few low-dimension operators and then a bunch of high-dimension operators and they're separated, then there should be a sense in which you can make sense of these operators moving through another local space, where some of them have a large mass and units of the ADS radius, and some of them have a small mass. So that's another major open question. And so in one of my papers, I forget which one, I studied a model where these tensors are taken to be random as a very crude model of a strongly interacting theory. So large random tensors. And those objects scramble things around a lot. So what you can show is that they typically have very, very high values for all these deltas. If you really put a random tensor in there, all the deltas would basically be very large. So it's like you only have high dimension operators. And so this matches, well, matches may be a strong word, but it's crudely similar to what you see in the understood cases of ADS-CFT, where you have a few high dimension operators, I mean a few low dimension operators, and many, many high dimension operators, and a separation of scales. But answering this question about what is really the structure of these tensors in any kind of large N approximation, strongly interacting approximation, is also a completely open question. Right. So if you have any idea for how to, you know, figure out what these things should look like, you know, that would be really good. And so one thing I mentioned in my talk on Monday was the idea of using the CFT bootstrap, which is to say that the data about dimensions and what are called operator product expansion coefficients obey equations. They have nice properties. And these equations simplify when you have the special limits of a large and strongly interacting conformal field theory. Things become simpler. And so I kind of think that there may be some way to relate the structure of these tensors, which are, after all, just encoding these data about dimensions in some way. There may be a way to relate these things to the data that you find in these operator products, these conformal bootstrap kind of things. But this is just a completely vague idea. So I was asked to say open question. So this is an open question. Yeah.
So in ADS-CFT, you have a precise relation between delta and the mass of the particle.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you get it exactly. So yeah, one thing I can say is that if you solve the graph Laplacian for its low-lying eigenvalues, you find that they're actually exactly the same as the eigenvalues of the wave operator in ADS. So in that sense, actually, like the massless states or the very low-lying states, they look kind of similar. But yeah, in general, I agree it's not clear how. I think you really need to interpret, you need to know something more about how to interpret this locality within the tensor. That's my kind of current picture. Okay, so let me just mention a few other words and then, you know, I'll stop talking. You can also imagine doing this, you can imagine doing MIRA for finite temperature states, not just ground states, right? Instead of minimizing the energy, minimize the free energy. And this can be done. It's unpublished work, but it can be done. And more generally, you know, what would you expect to happen? Right? You would expect, if I take a CFT and I turn on some finite temperature, what happens is I generate a correlation link. Things get screened by the temperature. And so what happens in ADS-CFT is you get a black hole. Looks like this. So now you have x and r. And this is t not equal to 0 now. And what happens is you get a black hole. Or in this case, a black brain, a planar black hole. R equals RH, the horizon, and RH, just by dimensional analysis, goes like 1 over temperature. So now everything is qualitatively different. If I had like a little region here, I'd still get the entanglement entropy, the usual log L for small regions. But if I make very big regions, like this, and what happens is they go down, but then they start to fill the horizon, run along the horizon, and then they come back up. But now this will be an extensive entropy, right? Because it runs along the horizon. So what's the length of this curve? The length is, roughly speaking, if this is R, it's R over RH, just our old formula. Only thing that changes in the black hole metric is this gets some different prefactor and this gets a different prefactor. But this part stays the same. So actually, this is the exactly correct formula. But RH is like 1 over T. So if you use the formula, now actually applied to black holes, and you get the entropy of the black hole is R over RH times LADS. There's a factor of LADS here over G Newton, which is RCT, which is the entropy of a CFT. It's the same C which appears here as in the entanglement entropy. So ADS CFT automatically reproduces that fact. And now if you did a MIRA, some kind of entanglement normalization scheme for this finite temperature thing, what would you expect to happen? Well, what you might imagine happening is that at first the network looks like the CFT network. But then as you go down, you start to see the fact that you are in a thermal state, that you have decaying correlations. And so as you run down, the network changes a little bit, becomes less and less entangled, more and more product state-like, until eventually you reach a point where everything is completely unentangled. And at that point, you could say you have a black hole horizon. And why might you say that? Well, it's sort of long known that at least for simple black holes, there's a sense in which the temperature of the black hole horizon diverges, the local temperature. If you're hovering at the black hole horizon, if you're hovering out here, you see very little radiation. If you're hovering here, you see a lot of radiation. It becomes very intense. And you can say, well, what does an infinite temperature state look like? If I take any Hamiltonian and I put the temperature equal to infinity, what is the density matrix? It's just a product of maximally mixed states on each site. Right? So indeed, if you ran the MIRA, you maybe have some part of the network. But then here, you reach just a factorized state. Let's see, some row. And you can imagine that this factorized state is interpreted as an infinite temperature state. It's sort of like the black hole horizon. So this is extremely crude, but I think it's very interesting because black holes are very interesting. So this is another completely open subject, is how to deal with, I mean, there are some comments and small results about finite temperature MIRA, but more generally, it's completely open. Well, so these are mixed states. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So yeah, really, this metric is actually, I mean, this picture is a little bit misleading. It's two tensor networks going in either direction, right? So you have it start with like some infrared density matrix, which is completely factorized, and then build out the correlations in both directions. Because now you have the bra and the ket both there. Right, is that what you were asking? Let me just draw a little picture. So you just imagine that you have rho naught, and then you Or if I was drawing it the way I was drawing it before, it'd be like. See what I'm saying? So I'm just taking the bra and the ket, and then putting them together into a density matrix. Okay. So the black holes are very interesting. I didn't get to talk about it at all, but you can do the toric code exactly. Giffray has a paper about this. And actually, I'll soon have a paper where I talk about doing these bulk excitations I was talking about on Monday in the toric code, how to interpret that. So in the toric code or any other topological theory, basically, you can do this all exactly. And you can see precisely that excitations down here correspond to large objects in the boundary. So this depth really is, you know, exactly like a coarse graining scale. And so if I make a bulk excitation here, it corresponds to a big floppy thing up there. So anyways, there's a long story there, but you can look at my paper when it comes out. So yeah, let me see what else. Let me just conclude by mentioning a few other open things. I don't know if anyone cares about this, but practical 2D work is still very primitive. I think that's fair to say. So we would really like to actually, I mean, there's no conceptual reason why this should not work in two dimensions, I feel. I don't know any obstruction, but numerically it's just quite challenging. So there's a lot of open room for doing some interesting new algorithmics, possibly motivated by string theory thinking or quantum gravity thinking. I don't know. But so I mentioned this large and strong coupling. What do the tensors look like in that kind of limit? That's totally open. Finite T, Mira. I've been working on this some, but there's still very little known. So that's, you know, trying to make contact with black hole physics. There's the continuous Mira, which, as I said, has all kinds of issues with it. It's not numerically very useful so far. But it's maybe an interesting way to look at free field theories. So there's a lot of calculations you could do there. Finite temperature calculations, even some dynamical calculations. This issue of translation variance is completely open, basically. I'm also working on this a little bit. This issue of bulk locality, which has to do, again, with large and strong coupling. How do you see that the theory is more local than this ADS scale locality? Dynamics, space-time, we know very little. We could figure out what GTT is, that is the time component of the metric, which I just erased, unfortunately, by studying how the Hamiltonian renormalizes. Right? You put the Hamiltonian up here, and you move it down, you can calculate the scaling dimension. So time runs slower the further down you get. Right? And that's telling you how GTT works. But that's a little bit indirect, a bit unsatisfying. So to understand how to put time dynamics in here in a more interesting way would be great. So there's also all kinds of other space-times. Not everything in the world is a CFT. There's also Fermi surfaces. Those are extremely interesting. And you can try to think about branching Mira. Or, you know, we've written down geometries that holographically should look more or less like Fermi surfaces. So can you, I made a brief discussion of how these things are related, but there's a lot of work you can do there. And that may be a place where C-Mira could be useful. I don't think people have done C-Mira for Fermi surfaces. Another extremely interesting thing which I'm working on a little bit right now is how this connects to Wilsonian RG. Right? This is really actually very different if you think about it from taking an imaginary time path integral and integrating out degrees of freedom in that. Because in that, when you do that, you don't even have a Hamiltonian theory at the end of the day. You know, you get all these higher time derivatives appearing. You know, it's a 10th order time derivative action. What does that mean? It's not a Hamiltonian system. Because you integrated out degrees of freedom. So here we're doing something very different in real space, I mean, in real time, and focusing on the state. So you might imagine that you could do something like take the path integral, cut it open, and put a boundary condition. That's the wave function, right? So then I do Wilsonian RG on the path integral and see that how that acts on the boundary condition. And then perhaps you can actually sort of show that this network structure appears out in some reasonably natural way from doing that. So that's one thing I'm working on right now, trying to think about. So yeah, and then one last thing, if you're more mathematically minded, is it'd be very interesting actually to show rigorously that these networks actually do approximate the ground states of interesting systems to some reasonable accuracy with some reasonable resources. Right. So we sort of have a lot of hopes and dreams, but not so much really concrete statements that these things really work in general. I mean, they have the right structure, but we don't really know. So I think there's room for really saying, you know, that this is the right answer for CFTs. Like if I made these bond dimensions of order system size, let's say, would that be sufficient to represent the ground state very faithfully, for example? Or how big do I need to make the dimension? So that's another open question. So yeah, thanks for coming and listening. That's all I have to say.